Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Still nil all in Sydney, still not a huge amount of evidence of the Matildas getting out of their own half. Further updates as the passage of play continues there. But I want to turn my attention now to the seas and to the marine heat waves. The sweltering heat this summer has put a pause to normal life in the Mediterranean as temperatures reach as high as 46 degrees. COVID-style protocols have been put in place in Italy to protect people from the heat. But it's not just land temperatures that are soaring. Last month, a Category 4 heat wave was declared in the North Atlantic off our own coast, with some hotspots hitting Category 5, which describes conditions which are beyond extreme. So how are fish and marine life coping with the heat? How have we impacted their environment? To tell us more, I'm joined by Ken O'Sullivan, an underwater cinematographer with a close to two decades experience of filming underwater, and Professor Stefano Mariani, a marine ecologist from the Liverpool John Moores University. Good morning to both of you, gentlemen. Stefano,
good morning.
Stefano, tell me, where have you dived? Where have you explored first, please?
Well, being an Italian that later moved to Ireland and Britain for my work, I've mostly primarily researched the Mediterranean and the North Atlantic. But then as my collaborative network expanded, I had the opportunity to work in the Indian Ocean, the Caribbean. At the moment, I'm collaborating with people on the Pacific coast of the United States, along the California coast. So I can say that I have a fairly decent idea of biodiversity across the globe.
That's exactly why I asked you the question. I was wondering what is, over the length of your career, your frame of reference here, and what changes are you noticing now?
Well, of course, as a marine biologist and as a really keen observer of the sea, I have observed some level of change since I was a kid, and then as a teenager, and then as a university student and an early career researcher. You constantly, whenever you go at sea, or you are on a fishing vessel, or you are actually snorkeling yourself, inevitably you observe the changes. The issue here is, are they just interesting, curious changes that happen over a year or two and then it fluctuates from one year to another one? Or is there a tendency, a trend, a certain directional change? And most of my life, I have observed things that could be explained with natural fluctuations, except for the last 4 or 5 years, where wherever I go, whether it is the southwest of England, Brittany or the Mediterranean, all of a sudden I start seeing things that are quite in your face, and fish species that you had never seen there for decades, and now they are very abundant, and others that have almost completely disappeared. And that is quite stark and quite perturbing in a way.
Ken, I hear from scuba divers anecdotal stuff like trigger fish, fish that used to come to Irish waters for a couple of months during the summer, now being here all year round. Are you seeing much of that kind of thing?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think as Stefano said, to evaluate change in a logical and a scientific manner, you really have to look over a long period of time. But there are some obvious changes that we've all seen. And triggerfish, actually, we started to see them about 16, 17 years ago in Irish waters. Now, we haven't seen too many lately, but there are some obvious changes. Well, I mean, the absence of fish is one of the things that we see, particularly in shallow waters, and I mean, the seas every day. We see things like more and new species of jellyfish, such as, for example, the Portuguese man-o-war. Now, I hasten to say, I talk to swimmers all the time, most of the jellyfish in our waters don't do us any harm. You might get a mild sting from a compass jellyfish, but the only two to worry about are the lion's mane and the Portuguese man-o-war. And they've come up here, I think they were first seen 6-7 years ago, because part of their body is above the water. It's a sail. It's called after the Portuguese warship because it looks like it under sail. And as our winds, prevailing winds in Ireland are southwesterlies, they've been blown up to our south and our west coast. So we're seeing those changes, absolutely. But I suppose, you know, the old people, the biggest dramatic, most dramatic change I've seen, Philip, is the old people would say they never remember the frequency and the ferocity of the storms that we've had in the last 10 years. And, of course, weather by its nature is uneven, but, you know, we've had well-documented huge damage here in the Clare Coast, Lynch and Kilkee, over the last number of winters, and then kind of slightly crazy climate aberrations. Like, it was a couple of years ago, farmers were cutting silage in January, and then we had a fodder crisis in May. So, yeah, considerable change.
Indeed. It's pretty basic physics, isn't it? Hotter waters means more water in the atmosphere, means more rain to be dumped over land. There's a kind of a philosophical question here. I mean, I know the science says that we're moving in an undesirable direction, but is there any way that you could regard this question to both of you, Stefano, you first, that this is just change and change will always happen and nature will adapt?
Well, that is a million-dollar question because, yes, to some extent, organisms with their ever-changing genomes are equipped with the ability to adapt, to evolve. It's a matter of timing because, obviously, in order to adapt, you have to pass on the favorable change, the change that is suitable to the new conditions over generations. And if the generations, the number of generations for this change to be fixed, sometimes it exceeds the speed at which the change is happening. So only a small amount of change can actually be fixed, and only a certain amount of organisms that have a very quick generation time can adapt. But the majority of them are not able to keep up with this very, very fast and sudden change. So what they do, either they die or they move away. And that's why we see the cold water species going further north, and the warmer water species expanding towards the areas where they had never been.
Indeed, as has been evidenced, I think, by lobster fishermen complaining about the arrival of the common octopus here, eating their trapped lobsters out of pots.
Absolutely, And last week I was in Brittany, and the French fishermen had never seen so much octopus. So it was filling all the nets that normally would be filled with cod, and then now all of a sudden they are harvesting octopus and selling off to Spain, and it's a completely new thing.
Ken, do you have a take on that, whether marine life can adapt to this pace of change or not?
Well, I mean, broadly speaking, Philip, you know, the planet will adapt. Life on the planet, as Stefano said, life will adapt. The question is, what are the consequences? And we know that they'll be catastrophic for lots of life forms, including humanity. I mean, planet Earth will be here in a billion years, more than likely. But the changes that we're causing to it have enormous consequences, as we're seeing. And, you know, warmer water, of course, it creates huge problems. Fish are largely cold-blooded creatures, by which we mean they don't regulate their body temperature. Their body temperature is that of their surrounding environment. Now, there are exceptions, of course, sharks and bluefin tuna. But if you're going to change the water temperature, and I think it's come up by about 1.3 degrees in the last 100 years or so, probably half a degree in Ireland in the last 10 years, if you're going to change that quite dramatically, of course, that has a huge impact. And we saw heat waves off the northwest of Ireland and the northeast of the UK of up to 3 degrees in that heat wave you mentioned earlier. So, you know, life adapts over hundreds of millions of years. It's the evolution of the species. But if it changes very, very quickly, then life can really, really struggle to cope with that. And there are dramatic consequences. So, you know, life, broadly speaking, will still be here in a billion years. But what forms will it be and what are the consequences?
Turning to the washed up whales that we see on our shores, Ken, more than likely than not, that is sound pollution made by human beings, sonar from military and so on. But is it possible that there is a climate element to that too?
Well, there likely is, of course, Philip. I mean, but probably the largest number of whales, you know, cause for whales washing up dead is that, you know, animals will die naturally, and a certain percentage of them will be washed on shore, particularly with our prevailing winds and tides and currents. But sound pollution is a huge issue in the ocean. It's officially a pollution under the EU Habitats Directive now. And these are animals, particularly cetaceans, whales and dolphins, that live in an acoustic world. It's their primary sense, as sight would be for us. So if we're putting a lot of noise into it, then we're interfering with them, or potentially interfering with them in many ways. In terms of the warming ocean causing whale strandings, I mean, I think it's difficult to know, really. I mean, undoubtedly, there's lots of movement of fish stocks and overfishing of certain fish stocks, and that's impacting on these animals because that's that's what they eat. So I would say probably, if you're talking about whale strandings, there are bigger impacts that are causing that, whales and dolphin strandings. But certainly, noise pollution, particularly military sonar, has been shown on many occasions now to cause huge problems for these animals because, you know, things like animals like sperm whales, pilot whales, beaked whales, you know, they can dive to 2,000-3,000 meters deep, certainly sperm whales. And what actually happens is the military sonar, which is incredibly loud and terrifies them, they surface too quickly and they get the bends, as scuba divers will, and we've had lots of them washed up with trauma to their ears and that. And of course, we all know there's lots of military activity southwest of Ireland over the last year or so with the various political stuff that's going on.
Stefano, there is no doubt that the chemical composition of the oceans is changing with all of this fresh water coming off the Greenland ice sheet and with this added temperature now as well. What's less certain amongst oceanographers when you talk to them is what impact this is having on our oceanic circulation. Some will say that it looks like it's slowing down and could halt in the North Atlantic. Others will say, no, I don't agree. Are you worried that policymakers are going to look for certainty from the scientists when scientists aren't actually in a position to provide that?
Yes, I mean, obviously the worry there is there because for decades I have worked in the field of marine biology in order to advise, obviously, policymaking, especially for fisheries. And the tendency is that, oh, we want to have a specific number, we want a specific threshold, we want to have really certain clear answers, and often scientists come up with this uncertainty and we have to find a balance, because the uncertainty when you have to predict what's going to happen, because as you say, it's very, very likely that all these changes in temperatures and chemistry will affect the circulation, but to what extent and how and where and when, it's another matter. Now, we should keep having a good conversation with the policymaker, making sure that on the one hand, we don't deliver a message of, oh, it's all uncertain, I don't know, we cannot see anything. But actually, we have the instruments and the ability to predict has improved. And we've got quite a lot of good models that can explain a lot more things compared to 20, 30, 40 years. So I think it's important that that level of uncertainty doesn't completely freeze everybody into a standstill, but that allows some level of action to be put in place in a precautionary measure, of course, because when we are a little bit more cautious, it's more likely that we are going to preserve a certain stock, we're going to preserve a certain fishery in the long term, or we are going to adapt to a new type of fishing, because that's another solution. The models are telling us it is more likely that we are going to be creating more value along the fishery and supply chain by focusing on something else and accepting what we used to be. Business as usual is no longer an option.
Science, Ken, might not be able to deliver precise numbers, a precise scenario or date, but it is very clearly signposting risk that we should avoid.
Yeah. I mean, you have to always be careful when you speak in broad sweeps, I suppose. But you know, for a topic like that, you have to. But isn't it well defined? I mean, I thought we're trying to keep the planet's temperature below 1.5 or 2 degrees, what it was before the Industrial Revolution, and there's been enormous amounts of modelling over decades as to what the impact of on our climate and our planet would be.
There has, but what I suppose I'm referring to there is the fact that we're talking about atmospheric temperature and we're completely focused on that, and we really overlook the oceans in policymaking.
Yeah, we do. I mean, it is difficult to put an exact number on that. But look, there's some very good statistics here. So, for example, did you know 93% of the Earth's warming that's been caused by greenhouse gases has been absorbed by our oceans? 93% since the early 1970s.
Doing us a big favour.
Now, if we didn't have that, large parts of the planet would be uninhabitable because they'd be 10, 20 degrees warmer than what they are at the moment. So, you know, in terms of policymakers, I don't know what exact numbers you can put in terms of ocean warming, but we all know it's very, very clear that the ocean regulates our temperatures. We remember from geography in school that you have continental climates that are very warm in the summer, very cold in the winter, and versus maritime climates like we have, where our temperature is regulated. And, of course, we have these well-documented oceanic currents like the Gulf Stream. You know, we're at the same latitude as Newfoundland, and we don't have the snow and ice and freezing conditions they have. We have a very mild climate. And yet there was some brilliant research from the Irish Marine Institute in May that shows that they anticipated 30% weakening of the Gulf Stream, which regulates our temperature. And indeed, there's the Great Ocean Conveyor Belt, which comes from the Arctic all the way across the planet down to the Antarctic. Now, that is driven to some degree by the Gulf Stream and the warmer waters hitting the Arctic. Now, if we interfere with that, of course, consequences can be catastrophic. So, to answer your question, it's very difficult to put an exact number, but in terms of the, you know, heat and convection between air and water are easily relatable, and I believe the 1.5 to 2 degree figure is what we need to aim for.
Ken O'Sullivan and Stefano Mariani, thank you both very much. We'll be taking a look at the ongoing Taylor Swift ticket controversy after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.